December 21st, 1924. Late afternoon in Münsterberg, Silesia. Winter darkness was already settling over the medieval market town, the kind of cold that made desperate men do desperate things. Vincenzo Olivier, a 35-year-old homeless carpenter, had been wandering these streets looking for work, for food, for anywhere warm to sleep. When the gray-bearded man at 19 Tristrasse offered him 20 pfennigs to write a simple letter, it seemed like providence. Papa Dinky, everyone in Münsterberg knew him, the church organ player, the kind landlord who helped travelers find lodging, the man who sold meat at fair prices during these hard times. Olivier sat at the desk in Dinky's ground floor apartment, pen in hand, ready to earn his 20 pfennigs. The old man dictated the opening. Adolf, du fetter wanst. Oliver paused, confused. Adolf, you fat slob. He turned his head to ask what this strange letter was about. That head turn saved his life. In his peripheral vision, Olivier saw the 64-year-old man raising a pickaxe toward the back of his skull. The blade meant for the base of his brain stuck in his temple instead, opening an 8-centimeter gash, 2 centimeters wide. Blood poured down his face, but Olivier was alive, conscious, fighting. He wrestled the weapon away from Dinky. The old man was stronger than he looked, but desperation gave Olivier strength. He broke free, stumbled through the door, and staggered into the street, screaming for help. A coachman named Gabriel found him first. Olivier, bleeding and barely coherent, managed to gasp out what had happened. Father Dinky, the beloved Papa Dinky, had attacked him with an axe. The pedestrians looked at each other. Papa Dinky? Impossible. There had to be a mistake. But the blood was real. The wound was real. Someone called the police. When officers arrived at Dinky's apartment, they found him calm, dismissive. It was self-defense, he explained. The vagrant had been violent, threatening. He'd had no choice. But Olivier's injuries told a different story. The axe wound, the terror, the desperate escape. A judge ordered Dinky held for questioning. At the police station, they placed him in a holding cell. Standard procedure. They'd question him in the morning, when Olivier was stable enough to give a full statement. Morning never came. Sometime in the night, Carl Dinky fashioned a noose from his clothing. He hanged himself in his cell before anyone could ask him a single question, before he could explain anything, before the full horror of what he'd done could be revealed. He chose his own end, just like the 30 people he'd killed over 21 years. When police searched his apartment the next day, they found a museum of murder. 2 wooden tubs filled with pickled human flesh. Over 400 human teeth sorted in containers. Belts, suspenders, and shoelaces crafted from tanned human skin. A ledger documenting 31 victims by name and their slaughter weight. Carl Dinky had been murdering homeless vagrants and selling their flesh as pork at weekly markets for over 2 decades. All while playing organ at the local church. All while his neighbors called him Papa. Hello, friend. Welcome to Foul Play.
Carl Dinky was born on the 11th of February, 1860, in Ober-Konzendorf, Silesia, in what was then Prussia and is today Poland, to a family of farmers. The youngest of three siblings, his early life was marked by hardship and strict discipline. His father, a demanding man who valued hard work above all else, often subjected young Carl to harsh punishment for even minor transgressions. Despite this challenging upbringing, Denker showed early signs of business acumen and social adaptability. He was often described as softly spoken and quiet, and the teachers at his elementary school said he was difficult to deal with and one of the worst pupils at the school. Following a particularly difficult confrontation with his father when he was just 12 years old, Denker decided it was time to run away from home. This early independence shaped his future, forcing him to learn self-reliance and develop the social skills that would later serve as his perfect cover. He took on various apprenticeships, starting as a gardener, eventually establishing himself as a landowner and businessman in Munsterbeer. At the age of 25, Denker's father died, and his eldest brother inherited the childhood home, though he did receive some money from the estate. He used the money to purchase a piece of land after deciding that he wanted to become a farmer, but his endeavour failed and he sold it shortly afterwards. He reinvested the money in a house which he rented out, but inflation rose and he was forced to sell it. Though he refused to move and lived in a small apartment to the right of the house's ground floor. His next venture was to acquire a small shop and a vending license and sell goods. Rather than specialise, he sold anything and everything, from leather goods to meat. The irony of Denker's position as a church organ player was not lost on those who would later investigate his crimes. Every Sunday he would sit at the organ playing hymns while his fellow congregants sang, completely unaware that the same hands touching those sacred keys had committed unspeakable acts. His participation in church activities and his reputation for charitable works created a perfect shield against suspicion. As his crimes continued, Denker became increasingly bold in his actions, yet paradoxically more entrenched in the community's good graces. He would often sell meat and other goods to the neighbours, claiming they came from his non-existent farm. His reputation for fair dealing and honest business practices only grew stronger, even as the number of his victims increased. The townspeople's trust in Papa Denker was so complete that even when travellers disappeared after taking lodgings with him, no one thought to question the kindly landlord who played organ at their church.
His first known victim was Ida Lawner, a vagrant travelling through Munsterberg in February 1903. She was the first name in his ledger, but marked as victim number 11. What happened to the first 10, Dinky never recorded. Their loss to history, their deaths known only to the man who killed them. Over the next 21 years, Dinky developed a methodical system of murder. He targeted society's invisible people, homeless vagrants, unemployed journeymen, recently released prisoners and mental patients, itinerant workers, looking for an opportunity. People who wouldn't be missed. People whose disappearances wouldn't be investigated. His reputation as Papa Dinky, the charitable church organist who helped travelers, was his hunting tool. He'd offer small payments, typically 20 pfennigs, for simple tasks. Write a letter. Help with some work. Come inside for a meal. Once seated at his desk, distracted by pen and paper, victims were struck from behind with a pickaxe. The blow targeted the base of the skull, meant to be instant, efficient. Some he strangled. All murders occurred in his ground floor apartment, with its convenient separate entrance, where neighbors couldn't see who came and went. After death came systematic processing that would have impressed a professional butcher. Dinky dismembered bodies with saws and axes, separated flesh from bones with methodical precision. He pickled strips of meat in two large wooden tubs filled with salt brine, the same brine solution used for preserving pork. He rendered human fat for soap. He boiled bones clean. then ground them for fertilizer, or stored them in his garden shed. And most grotesquely, he tanned human skin to manufacture leather goods, the very belts, suspenders, and shoelaces he sold at weekly markets. Dinky held an official vendor's license from the Butchers Guild of Breslau. Authorities had inspected his goods, approved his business, given him legal standing to sell meat products at public markets, including the prestigious Hall of a Target Market Hall in Wrocław. During the post-war years, when meat shortages made cheap protein precious as gold, his boneless pickled pork found eager buyers. No one questioned why the gentle church organist had such a steady supply of quality meat. His ledger documented everything. Each entry included the victim's slaughter weight, dead weight, naked weight, disemboweled weight. The accounting of a man who saw human beings as livestock. Among his documented victims, Adolf Zelisch, a confectioner, Rakush Pavlik, a fur dealer, killed just 34 days before Olivier's narrow escape, Johann Matuschek, Andreas Picart, Paul Guler, Rudolf Fiedler, Edward Krabisch, Joseph Schultz, Karl Reichter, Michael Heider. Ages ranged from 16 to 76 years old. 26 men, 4 women, all invisible in life, all intended to be invisible in death. Dinky didn't prey on them despite their vulnerability. He preyed on them because of it, because society had already declared these lives expendable, because no one would come looking for them. Because in Weimar, Germany's economic catastrophe, homeless vagrants disappeared every day, and no one cared enough to ask why. Christmas Eve, 1924, 3 days after Dinky's suicide, police conducted a full search of his apartment at 19 Tristrasse. What they found defied comprehension. In his single ground floor room, 2 large wooden tubs containing human flesh, pickled in brine solution, ready for sale. 3 pots held partially consumed cooked human meat, a pot of human skin and aorta pieces, set in a gelatinous mass. A bowl of amber-colored human fat gleamed in the winter light. Blood stains covered the apartment, including his bed, where he'd slept among his victims' remains for years. In his garden shed, they found a barrel filled with clean and cooked bones, over 480 individual pieces, and teeth stored in containers sorted like coins, grim trophies of decades of murder. On windowsills and tables, identification papers from dozens of victims, many recently released from prisons or mental hospitals. In his closet, blood-stained clothing, including one woman's skirt. Hanging on walls, belts, suspenders, and shoelaces made from tanned human skin. The suspenders he'd worn on his own body, found after his suicide, were crafted from human skin, with the nipples still visible. The same man who played church organ on Sundays had worn human beings as clothing.
Most disturbing were the numerous leather goods found throughout the residence, belts, shoelaces, braces, and suspenders, all of which were later confirmed to be made from human skin. The sheer volume of evidence suggested that Denker had been operating his gruesome enterprise for years. Among the items discovered were piles of clothing belonging to his victims, carefully sorted and stored. Human bones were found stripped clean of flesh, many showing signs of having been boiled. A detailed report of these were made. 16 femurs, with one pair of remarkably strong ones, two pairs of very thin ones, 6 pairs and 2 left femurs, 15 medium-sized pieces of long bones, 4 pairs of elbow bones, 7 heads of radii, 9 lower parts of radii, 8 lower parts of the elbow, a pair of upper shin bones, a pair of lower elbows and radii, of which extremities still remain well connected, a pair of upper arms and a pair of upper arm heads, a pair of collarbones, 2 shoulder blades, 8 heels and ankle bones, 120 toes and phalanx, 65 feet bones, 5 first ribs and 150 pieces of ribs. Several large barrels contained what appeared to be pickled human flesh, suggesting that Denker had developed efficient methods for preserving his victim's remains. Perhaps the most shocking was the revelation that Denker had been selling products made from his victims to unsuspecting townspeople. He had developed a reputation for producing high-quality leather goods and meat products, which he sold at local markets. The investigation revealed that much of this merchandise was actually derived from human remains. Denker had even supplied local restaurants with what he claimed was pork, but was later suspected to be human flesh. The impact on Munster Bear's community was devastating. The revelation that a trusted member of their society had not only murdered dozens of people, but had potentially fed human flesh to his unsuspecting neighbours, shattered the community's sense of security. The fact that he had operated so openly, selling his products at local markets and maintaining regular social interactions, forced people to question their ability to truly know those around them. The case exposed significant weaknesses in law enforcement practices at the time. Denker's ability to operate undetected for so long revealed the lack of coordination between different police jurisdictions and the absence of systematic missing persons investigations. His victims, primarily society's most vulnerable members, highlighted the need for greater protection of marginalised populations and more thorough investigation of disappearances, regardless of social status. The legacy of Karl Denker's crimes extends far beyond the borders of Munsterbear and the era in which he operated. His case became a crucial analyst for changes in German law enforcement, particularly in how police departments communicate across jurisdictions about missing persons cases. Perhaps the most significant impact of the Denker case was its influence on the development of criminal profiling. His ability to maintain a respected public persona while committing horrific acts helped shape our understanding of how serial killers can integrate themselves into society. The case stands as one of the earliest documented examples of what criminologists now call the organised killer. Someone who can maintain a seemingly normal life while methodically planning and executing their crimes. The historical significance of the case also lies in its timing. Occurring during the tumultuous period of the Weimar Republic, Denker's crimes exposed the dark underbelly of a society in crisis. His ability to exploit the widespread poverty and displacement of the post-war period serves as a grim reminder of how societal breakdown can create perfect conditions for predatory behaviour to flourish. The lessons learnt from this case about the importance of thorough investigation, the need to protect society's most vulnerable, and the danger of assuming virtue based on social standing remain as relevant today as they were nearly a century ago.
This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Look, the new year doesn't have to mean reinventing yourself. That's exhausting. Maybe it's just about carrying less. For me, that meant letting go of the pressure to have everything figured out. The doubt that whispered I wasn't building something real. Turns out, those weights were heavier than I realized, and I couldn't see how heavy until I had someone outside my own head help me look at them. That's what therapy can do. An unbiased perspective to help you understand what's actually holding you back. Your relationships, your motivations, the stories you tell yourself. BetterHelp has over 30,000 licensed therapists. They've helped more than 5 million people find their footing. They handle the matching work for you. And if your therapist isn't the right fit, you can switch anytime. BetterHelp makes it easy to get matched online with a qualified therapist. Sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. Carl Dinky killed at least 30 people, probably more. His crimes were as horrific as those of his infamous contemporaries, Fritz Haman and Peter Curtin, the so-called vampire of Dusseldorf. Yet while those names echo through criminal history, Dinky became a footnote, the forgotten cannibal. His immediate suicide prevented any sensational trial. A few articles appeared in local Silesian papers in December 1924. Left-wing newspapers accused authorities of suppressing the story to protect the reputation of the church and the Butchers' Guild. Within weeks, the case vanished from headlines. Within years, it was overshadowed by other monsters. Then came World War II. Münsterberg became Polish Zeebies. German residents were expelled. Records scattered. The case fell between German and Polish historiography. Too German for Polish scholars. Too geographically displaced for Germans. A 21-year killing spree reduced to academic footnotes, then nearly lost entirely. The house at Stavova Street 13, formerly Treistrasse, passed to new owners who had no idea what had happened there. In the 1970s, human bones were discovered in a neighbor's garden during renovations. Dinky's disposal methods still surfacing half a century later. In 1999, researcher Lucina Biawi, custodian of the Silesian Library at Wrocław University, accidentally rediscovered the case while preparing a catalog of Silesian press archives. Her research identified 20 victims by name, documented the Butchers' Guild license, brought academic attention to crimes that had nearly been forgotten forever. In 2013, German criminologist Armin Reuters published a comprehensive monograph with psychological analysis. Two films about Dinky appeared in April 2024, 100 years after his crimes, with sold-out screens in Germany. The house still stands. Gray one-story building at Stavova Street 13 in Zeebies, Poland. Over 120 years old. Largely unchanged since 1924. The family who has owned it since 1972 had it blessed by a Catholic priest. They've posted no photo signs. They're hostile to dark tourists. A journalist was reportedly threatened with an axe. No memorial plaque marks the site. No acknowledgement of what happened there. You can see it on Google Street View, the ordinary-looking building where at least 30 people were murdered, processed, and sold as pork. Ida Launer, Adolf Silesch, Rachis Pollock, Joanna Motaszek, Andreas Pikart, Paul Galler, Rudolf Fiedler, Edward Kreibisch, Joseph Schultz, Carl Reiter, Michael Hader, and at least 20 more whose names weren't preserved, whose stories, who they were, who loved them, what dreams they carried as they wandered desperate roads seeking work, are lost to history. They were invisible in life, intended to be invisible in death, their humanity reduced to weights in a ledger. Only Vincennes Olivier survived to tell the story. That turn of his head, that moment of confusion over a bizarre phrase, "Adolf, you fat slob," saved his life. and exposed 2 decades of murder. Carl Dinky became the forgotten cannibal, not because people didn't know about him, but because forgetting was easier than remembering. Because his victims were people society had already decided didn't matter. Because the same forces that enabled his crimes, indifference to the vulnerable, trust in respectable facades, economic desperation that makes certain lives expendable, made it easier to look away. Those forces haven't disappeared. Society's indifference to the vulnerable creates perfect hunting grounds for predators. When we decide lives don't matter, we don't just fail the victims, we enable their killers. Until next time, thanks for listening, friend.